As the bus rocked and rolled its way down the curving hills overlooking the bay, the sky turned pink and gold in the sunset. Socrates made a feeble attempt to summarize my lessons, while I did my best to ignore him and snuggle with Joy in the back seat. "She'll only lead you down the primrose path," he grinned. "Even a young fool in the throes of love cannot fail to see how his mind creates both his disappointments and his joys." The bus stopped at the bottom of the hill. Joy rose quickly and got off the bus, followed by Socrates. I started to follow, but he glanced back and said, "No." That was all. Joy looked at me through the open window. "Joy, when will I see you again?" "Perhaps soon. It depends," she said.
"Depends on what?" I said.
But the bus was pulling away from them. Joy and Sock had already disappeared into the darkness. Sunday, I sank into a deep depression over which I had no control. Monday in class, I hardly heard a word my professor said. I was preoccupied during the workout, and my energy was drained. I had not eaten since the picnic. I prepared myself for my Monday night gas station visit. She was there, all right, laughing with Socrates when I entered the office. Feeling like a stranger, I wondered if they were laughing at me. I went in, took off my shoes, and sat.
"Try to relax, Dan," Joy said. I know she was trying to help, but I felt overwhelmed, criticized by both of them.
"Dan," Socrates continued, "if you remain blind to your weaknesses, you can't correct them, nor can you play up your strengths. It's just like gymnastics. Look at yourself." I could hardly speak. When I did, my voice quavered with tension, anger, and self-pity. "I am looking. I didn't want to act like this in front of her." Blithely, Socrates went on. "I've already told you that your compulsive attention to the mind's moods and impulses is a basic error. If you persist, you'll remain yourself, and I can't imagine a worse fate." I sat very still and clenched my fists. Finally, I could speak. "I don't think either of you is very funny." I kept my voice tightly controlled. Socrates leaned back in his chair and with cold-blooded cruelty said, "You're angry, but doing a mediocre job of hiding it, jackass." "Your anger," he continued, "is proof of your stubborn illusions. Why defend a self you don't even believe in? When are you going to grow up?" "Listen, you crazy old bastard," I screeched. "Your world seems full of suffering, not mine. I'm depressed, all right, but only when I'm here with you."
Neither Joy nor Socrates said a word. They just nodded their heads, looking sympathetic and compassionate.
Damn their compassion. "You both think everything is so clear and so simple and so funny." Blind with embarrassment, confusion, and pain, I lurched out the door, swearing to myself that I would forget him, forget her, and forget I'd ever walked into that station late one starry night. My indignation was a sham, and I knew it. What was worse, I knew they knew it. I'd blown it. I felt weak and foolish, like a small boy. I could bear losing face in front of Socrates, but not in front of her. And now I felt sure I'd lost her forever. Running through the streets, I found myself going in the opposite direction from home. I ended up in a bar on University Avenue near Grove Street. I got as drunk as I could, and when I finally made it to my apartment, I was grateful for unconsciousness. I could never go back. I decided to try and take up the normal life I'd tossed aside months ago. The first thing was to catch up on my studies if I was to graduate. Susie loaned me her history notes, and I got psychology notes from one of my teammates. I stayed up late writing papers. I drowned myself in books. I had a lot to remember and a lot to forget. At the gym, I trained to exhaustion. I turned what few ounces of fat I had left into gristle and muscle. I looked hard, like one of Michelangelo's statues. I went to movies almost every night, but couldn't get the image of Socrates sitting in the station, maybe with Joy, out of my mind. Sometimes I had a dark vision of them both sitting there laughing at me. I didn't spend time with Susie or any other women I knew. What sexual urges I had were spent in training, washed away by sweat. My life became an ordeal. Other people's laughter hurt my ears. I imagined Socrates and Joy cackling like warlock and witch, plotting against me. The movies I sat through had lost their colors. The food I ate tasted like paste. I'd begun to drift through the routine of school like a phantom. My world was turning inside out and upside down. I had tried to rejoin the old ways I knew, to motivate myself in my studies and training, but nothing made sense anymore. Meanwhile, professors rattled on and on about the Renaissance, the instincts of the rat, and Milton's middle years. I walked through Sproul Plaza each day amid campus demonstrations, and walked through sit-ins as if in a dream. None of it meant anything to me.
Student power gave me no comfort. Drugs could give me no solace. So I drifted, a stranger in a strange land, caught between two worlds without a handhold in either one. Late one afternoon, I sat in a redwood grove near the bottom of campus, waiting for the darkness, thinking about the best ways to kill myself. I no longer belonged on this earth. Somehow I'd lost my shoes. I had on one sock, and my feet were brown with dried blood. I felt no pain, nothing. I became unaccountably sad then, and started to cry. My body shook with anguish. I turned and ran a few hundred yards and collapsed on the path. I was too weary to go home to do anything. Maybe that's what saved me. I awoke in the infirmary. There was an IV needle in my arm. Someone had shaved me and cleaned me up. I was released the next afternoon. I felt rested, at least. That night, I dragged myself to the station. Joy was not there. Part of me suffered exquisite disappointment. I wanted so much to look into her eyes again, to hold her and be held, but part of me was relieved. I was one-on-one again, Sock and me. When I sat down, he said nothing of my absence, only, "You look tired and depressed," he said without a trace of pity. My eyes filled with tears. "Yes, I'm depressed. I came to say goodbye. I owe you that. I'm stuck halfway and I can't stand it anymore. I don't want to live." "You're wrong about two things, Dan." He came over and sat beside me on the couch. "First, you're not halfway yet, not by a long shot. But you are very close to the end of the tunnel. And the second thing," he said, reaching for my temple, "is that you're not going to kill yourself." I glared at him. "Says who?" Then I realized we were no longer in the office. We were sitting in a cheap hotel room. There was no mistaking the musty smell, the thin gray carpets, the two tiny beds and the small cracked second-hand mirror. "What's going on?" For the moment, the life was back in my voice. These journeys were always a shock to my system. I felt a rush of energy. "A suicide attempt is in progress. Only you can stop it." "I killed myself just yet," I said. "Not you, fool. The young man outside the window on the ledge. He's attending the University of Southern California. His name is Donald. He plays soccer, and he's a philosophy major. He's in his senior year, and he doesn't want to live. Go to it." Socrates gestured toward the window. "Socrates, I can't." "Then he'll die." I looked out the window and saw, about 15 stories below, groups of tiny people looking up from the streets of downtown Los Angeles. Peeking around the side of the window, I saw a light-haired young man in brown Levi's and a T-shirt standing 10 feet away on the narrow ledge looking down. He was getting ready to jump. Not wanting to startle him, I called his name softly. He didn't hear me. I called again. "Donald!" He jerked his head up and almost fell. "Don't come near me," he warned. Then, "How do you know my name?" "A friend of mine knows you, Donald. May I sit on the ledge here and talk to you? I won't come any closer." "No, no more words." His face was lax. His monotone voice had already lost its life. "Don, did people call you Don?" "Yeah," he answered automatically. "Okay, Don. I guess it's your life. Anyway, 99% of the people in this world kill themselves." "What the hell is that supposed to mean?" he said, an edge of life coming back into his voice. He started gripping the wall more tightly. "Well, I'll tell you. The way most people live kills them. You know what I mean, Don? They may take 30 or 40 years to kill themselves, by smoking or drinking or stress or overeating, but they kill themselves just the same." I edged a few feet closer. I had to choose my words carefully. "Don, my name is Dan. I wish we could spend more time talking. We might have some things in common. I'm an athlete, too, up at UC Berkeley." "Well..." He stopped and started to shake. "Listen, Don, it's getting a little scary for me to sit up here on this ledge. I'm going to stand up so I can hold on to something." I stood slowly. I was shaking a little myself. "Jesus," I thought, "what am I doing out here on this ledge?" I spoke softly, trying to find a bridge to him. "Don, I hear there's going to be a beautiful sunset tonight. The Santa Ana winds are blowing some storm clouds in. Are you sure you never want to see another sunset or sunrise? Are you sure you never want to go hiking in the mountains again?" "I've never been to the mountains," he said. "You wouldn't believe it, Don. Everything is pure up there, the water, the air. You can smell pine needles everywhere. Maybe we could go hiking together. What do you think?" Hell, if you want to kill yourself, you can always do it after you've at least seen the mountains.
There, I'd said all I could say. Now it was up to him. As I talked, I'd wanted more and more for him to live. I was only a few feet from him now.
Stop, he said. I want to die now.
I give up.
All right, I said. Then I'm going with you. I've already seen the goddamn mountains anyway.
He looked at me for the first time.
You're serious, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm serious. Are you going first, or am I?
But, he said, why do you want to die? It's crazy. You look so healthy. You must have a lot to live for.
Look, I said, I don't know what your troubles are, but my problems dwarf yours. You couldn't even begin to grasp them. I'm through talking.
I looked down.
It would be so easy. Just lean out and let gravity do the rest. And for once, I'd prove smug old Socrates wrong. I could exit laughing, yelling, you were wrong, you old bastard, all the way down until I smashed my bones and crushed my organs and cut myself off from the coming sunsets forever.
Wait!
It was Don, reaching out for me. I hesitated, then grasped his hand. As I looked into his eyes, Don's face began to change. It narrowed. His hair grew darker. His body grew smaller. I was standing there looking at myself. Then the mirror image disappeared, and I was alone. Startled, I took a step backward and slipped. I fell, tumbling over and over. In my mind's eye, I saw the terrible hooded specter waiting expectantly below. I heard Sock's voice, yelling from somewhere above. 10th floor, lingerie, bedspreads, 8th floor, housewares, cameras. I was lying on the office couch, looking up into Sock's gentle smile.
Well, he said, are you going to kill yourself?
No. But with that decision, the weight and responsibility of my life once again fell upon me. I told him how I felt. Socrates grasped my shoulders and only said, stay with it, Dan. Before I left that night, I asked him, where's Joy? I want to see her again.
In good time. She'll come to you later, perhaps.
But if I could only talk to her, it would make things so much easier.
Whoever told you it would be easy?
Socrates, I said, I have to see her.
You don't have to do anything except to stop seeing the world from the viewpoint of your own personal cravings. Loosen up. When you lose your mind, you'll come to your senses.
Until then, however, I want you to continue to observe as much as possible the debris of your mind.
If I could just call her.
Get to it, he said. In the following weeks, the noise in my mind reigned supreme. Wild, random, stupid thoughts, guilts, anxieties, cravings, noise. Even in sleep, the deafening soundtrack of my dreams assaulted my ears. Socrates had been right all along. I was in prison. It was a Tuesday night when I ran to the station at 10 o'clock, bursting into the office. I moaned, Socrates, I'm going to go mad if I can't turn down the noise. My mind is wild. It's everything you told me.
Very good, he said, the first realization of a warrior.
If this is progress, I want to regress.
Dan, when you get on a wild horse that you believe is tame, what happens?
It throws you, or kicks your teeth in.
Life has, in its own amusing way, kicked your teeth in many times.
I couldn't deny it.
But when you know the horse is wild, you can deal with it appropriately.
I think I understand, Socrates.
Don't you mean you understand, you think?
He smiled.
I left with instructions to let my realization stabilize for a few more days. I did my best. My awareness had grown these past few months, but I entered the office with the same questions.
Socrates, I finally realized the extent of my mental noise. My horse is wild. Now how can I tame it?
How do I turn down the noise? What can I do?
He scratched his head. Well, I guess you're just going to have to develop a very good sense of humor. He bellowed with laughter, then yawned and stretched. Not the way most people usually do, with arms extended out to the side, but just like a cat. He rounded his back, and I heard his spine go crack, 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 crack.
Socrates, did you know that you look just like a cat when you stretched?
I suppose I do, he replied nonchalantly. It's a good practice to copy the positive traits of various animals, just as we might imitate positive qualities of some humans. I happen to admire the cat. It moves like a warrior.
And as it happens, you have modeled yourself after the jackass. It's time you started to expand your repertoire, don't you think?
Yes, I suppose it is, I answered calmly. I excused myself and went home early, just after midnight,
and slept for 5 hours before my alarm woke me, and I doubled back toward the station. At that moment, I had made a secret resolution. No more playing victim, someone he could feel superior to. I was going to be the hunter. I was going to stalk him. It was still an hour until dawn when his shift would end. I hid in the bushes that lined the bottom edge of campus near the station. I would follow him and somehow find Joy. Peering through the foliage, I watched his every move. My thoughts quieted in the intensity of my vigil. My sole desire was to find out about his life away from the station, a subject about which he'd always been silent. Now I'd track down the answers myself. Like an owl, I stared at him. I saw as never before how smooth, how graceful he was. He washed windows without a wasted movement, slipped the nozzle into the gas tank like an artist. Socrates went into the garage, probably to work on a car. I grew weary. The sky was already light when I roused myself from what must have been a few minutes of shut-eye. Oh, no, I'd missed him. Then I saw him, busy with his last-minute duties. My heart constricted as he walked out of the station, crossed the street, and headed directly toward where I sat, stiff, shivery, and achy, but well hidden. I just hoped he didn't feel like beating around the bush this morning. I faded back into the foliage and calmed my breathing. A pair of sandals glided past, no more than 4 feet from my temporary lair. I could barely hear his soft footsteps. He followed a path that forked right. Quickly but cautiously, I scampered along the path like a squirrel. Socrates walked at a surprising clip. I barely kept up with his long strides and nearly lost him, when, far ahead, I saw a head of white hair entering Doe Library. What, I thought, could he be doing there, of all places? Tingling with excitement, I closed in. Once past the large oak door, I cut past a group of early bird students who turned and laughed, watching me. I ignored them as I tracked my prey down a long corridor. I saw him turn right and disappear. I sprinted to where he had disappeared. There could be no mistake. He had entered this door. It was the men's room, and there was no other exit. I didn't dare go in. I stationed myself in a nearby phone booth. 10 minutes passed. 20 minutes. Could I have missed him? My bladder was sending out emergency signals. I had to go in. Not only to find Socrates, but to make use of the facilities. And why not? This was my domain, after all, not his. I could make him explain. Still, it would be awkward. Entering the tiled bathroom, I saw no one at first. After finishing my own business, I started to search more carefully. There was no other door, so we still had to be there. One guy came out of a stall and saw me hunched over looking under the stalls. He hurried out the door with wrinkled brow, shaking his head. Back to the business at hand. I ducked my head for a quick look under the last stall. First I saw the backs of a pair of sandal feet. Then suddenly Sock's face dropped into view, upside down with a lopsided grin. He obviously had his back to the door and was bending forward, his head down between his knees. I stumbled backward in shock, completely disoriented. I had no good reason for my bizarre bathroom behavior. Socrates swung the stall door open and finished with a flourish. Woo-wee! A man can get constipated when he's being stalked by a junior warrior. As his laughter thundered through the tiled room, I reddened. He had done it again. I could almost feel my ears lengthen as I was once again transformed into a jackass. My body churned with a mixture of shame and anger. I could feel my face turn red. I glanced at the mirror, and there, tied neatly in my hair, was a perky yellow ribbon. Things began to make sense. The people's smiles and laughter as they'd walked through campus. The strange looks I'd gotten from my fellow bathroom occupant. Socrates must have pinned it to my head while I dozed off in the bushes. Suddenly very tired, I turned and walked out the door. Just before it swung shut, I heard Socrates say, not without a tone of sympathy in his voice, "That was just to remind you who is the teacher and who is the student." That afternoon, I trained like the unleashed furies of hell. I talked to no one, and wisely no one said a word to me. I quietly raged and swore I'd do whatever was necessary to make Socrates acknowledge me as a warrior. One of my teammates stopped me on the way out and handed me an envelope. "Someone left this in the coach's office. It's addressed to you, Dan. A fan of yours?" "I don't know. Thanks, Herb." I stepped outside the door and ripped open the envelope. On an unlined piece of paper was written, "Anger is stronger than fear, stronger than sorrow. Your spirit is growing. You are ready for the sword. Socrates." Chapter 3. Cutting Free. The next morning, I decided to relax before tackling my daily activities, so I pulled out my small TV and dumped some cookies into a bowl. Switching on a soap opera, I immersed myself in someone else's problems. As I watched, mesmerized by the drama, I reached for another cookie and discovered that the bowl was empty. Could I have eaten all those cookies? Later that morning, I went running around Edwards Field. There I met Dwight, who worked up at the Lawrence Hall of Science in the Berkeley Hills. I had to ask his name a second time because I didn't catch it the first time. Another reminder of my feeble attention and wandering mind. After a few laps, Dwight remarked about the cloudless blue sky. I had been so lost in thought I hadn't even noticed the sky. Then he headed for the hills. He was a marathon runner. And I returned home, thinking about my mind. A self-defeating activity, if ever there was one. I observed that in the gym I kept my attention focused precisely on every action. But when I stopped soaring, my thoughts would again obscure my perception. That night, I walked to the station early, hoping to greet Socrates at the beginning of his shift. By now, I'd done my best to forget about yesterday's incident in the library and was ready to hear any antidote to my hyperactive mind that Soc cared to suggest. I waited. Midnight arrived. Soon after, so did Socrates. Soc put the tea kettle on, and I began, as was my custom, with a question. Socrates, how do I stop my thoughts, my mind, other than by developing a sense of humor? First, you need to understand where your thoughts come from, Dan, how they arise in the first place. When the mind resists life, thoughts arise. When something happens to conflict with a belief, turmoil is set up. Thought is an unconscious reaction to life. A car rolled into the station bearing a formally dressed older couple who sat like ramrods in the front seat. Come with me, Sock ordered. He removed his windbreaker and his cotton sport shirt, revealing a bare chest and shoulders with lean, well-defined muscles. He walked up to the driver's side of the car and smiled at the shocked pair. What can I do for you folks? Gasoline to fuel your spirits? Perhaps oil to smooth out the rough spots in your day? How about a new battery to put a little charge in your life? He winked at them openly and stood his ground, smiling as the car lurched forward and sped away from the station. He scratched his head. Maybe they just remembered that they left the water running at home. While we relaxed in the office, sipping our tea, Socrates explained his lesson. You saw that man and woman resist what to them represented an abnormal situation. Conditioned by their values and fears, they haven't learned to cope with spontaneity. I could have been the highlight of their day. You see, Dan, when you resist what happens, your mind begins to race. The same thoughts that impinge upon you were actually created by you. And your mind works differently, I asked. My mind is like a pond without ripples. Your mind, on the other hand, is full of waves because you feel separated from, and often threatened by, an unplanned, unwelcome occurrence. Your mind is like a pond into which has been dropped a boulder. As I listened, I gazed into the depths of my teacup when I felt a touch just behind my ears. Suddenly my attention intensified. I stared deeper and deeper into the cup, down, down. I was underwater, looking up. This was ridiculous. Had I fallen into my own teacup? I had fins and gills. Very fishy. I whipped my tail and darted to the bottom, where it was silent and peaceful. Suddenly, a huge rock crashed into the water's surface. Shock waves slapped me backwards. My fins whipped the water again, and I took off, seeking shelter. I hid until everything quieted down again. As time passed, I became accustomed to the little stones that sometimes fell into the water, making ripples. The large plunks, however, still startled me. In a world filled with sound and dryness again, I lay on the couch, looking up, wide-eyed, at Sock's smile. You were a very nervous fish, fleeing from every large ripple. Later you became used to the ripples, but still had no insight into their cause. You can see, he continued, that a magnificent leap of awareness is required for the fish to extend its vision beyond the water in which it is immersed to the source of the ripples. A similar leap of awareness will be required of you. When you understand the source clearly, you'll see that the ripples of your mind have nothing to do with you. You'll just watch them, without attachment, no longer compelled to overreact every time a pebble drops. You will be free of the world's turbulence as you calm your thoughts. Remember, when you are troubled, let go of your thoughts and deal with your mind. Socrates, how? A not so bad question, he exclaimed. As you've learned from your physical training, leaps of gymnastics or of awareness don't happen all at once. They require time and practice. And the practice of insight into the source of your own ripples is called meditation. With that grand announcement, he excused himself and went to the bathroom. Now it was time to spring my surprise on him. I yelled from the couch so he could hear me through the bathroom door. "I'm one step ahead of you, Socrates. I joined a meditation group a week ago. I thought I'd do something myself about this old mind of mine," I explained. "We sit together for half an hour each evening. I'm already starting to relax more and get some control over my thoughts. Have you noticed I've been calmer? Say, Sock, do you practice meditation? If not, I can show you what I've learned." The bathroom door blasted open just then, and Socrates came straight at me, screaming a blood-curdling shriek, holding a gleaming samurai sword over his head. Before I could move, the sword slashed at me, cutting silently through the air and stopped inches over my head. I looked up at the hovering sword, then at Socrates. He grinned at me. "Oh, you sure know how to make an entrance. You scared the crap out of me," I gasped. The blade ascended slowly. Poised over my head, it seemed to capture and intensify all the light in the room. It shone in my eyes and made me squint. I decided to shut up. But Socrates only knelt on the floor in front of me, gently placed the sword between us, closed his eyes, took a deep breath, and sat perfectly still. I watched him for a while, wondering if this sleeping tiger would awaken and leap at me if I moved. 10 minutes passed, then 20. I started to fidget and got up quietly to get a drink of water. I was filling my mug when he put his hand on my shoulder. Water sloshed over my shoes as my hand jerked. "Socrates, I wish you wouldn't sneak up on me like that. Couldn't you make some noise?" He smiled and spoke. "Silence is the warrior's art, and meditation is his sword. It is the central weapon you'll use to cut through your illusions. But the sword's usefulness depends upon the swordsman. You don't yet know how to use the weapon, so it can become a dangerous, deluding, or useless tool in your hands. The warrior, on the other hand, uses the sword with skill and deep understanding, slashing through thoughts to reveal their lack of substance. What you need to stay on the right track, then, is a special map that covers the entire terrain you will explore. Step into the office, and I'll give you just the map you need." We entered through the garage door. I plopped onto the couch. Socrates settled without a sound between the massive armrests of his plush chair. He stared at me for a full minute. "Uh-oh," I said nervously under my breath. "Something's up." "The problem is," he sighed at last, "that I can't describe the terrain for you, at least not in so many words." He rose and walked toward me with that shine in his eye that told me to pack my suitcases. I was going on a trip. For an instant, from a vantage point somewhere in space, I felt myself expanding at the speed of light, ballooning, exploding to the outermost limits of existence, until I was the universe. Nothing separate remained. I had become everything. I was consciousness, recognizing itself. I was the pure light that physicists equate with all matter, that poets define as love. I was one, and I was all, outshining all the worlds. In that moment, the eternal, the unknowable had been revealed to me as an indescribable certainty. In a flash, I was back in my mortal form, floating among the stars. I saw a prism shaped like a human heart, which dwarfed every galaxy. It diffracted the light of consciousness into an explosion of radiant colors, sparkling splinters of every rainbow hue, spreading throughout the cosmos. My own body became a radiant prism then, throwing splinters of multicolored light everywhere. And it came to me that the highest purpose of the human body is to become a clear channel for this light, so that its brightness can dissolve all obstructions, all knots, all resistance. I felt the light diffracted across the systems of my own body. Then I knew that awareness is how the human being experiences the light of consciousness. I learned the meaning of attention. It is the intentional channeling of awareness. I felt my body again as a hollow vessel. I looked at my legs. They filled up with warm, radiant light, disappearing into brightness. I looked at my arms, with the same result. I focused attention on every part of the body until I became wholly light once again. Finally, I realized the process of real meditation: to expand awareness, to direct attention, to ultimately surrender to the light of consciousness itself. A light flickered in the darkness. I awoke to Socrates shining a flashlight back and forth across my eyes. "Power failure," he said, baring his teeth like a Halloween pumpkin as he held the light up to his face. "Well, is it all a bit clearer now?" he asked, as if I had just learned how a light bulb worked, rather than seen the soul of the universe. I could hardly speak. "You see," he said lightly, "these little journeys do save some difficult explanations I must go through to enlighten you." Just then the lights flashed on, and we both laughed. He reached into a small refrigerator next to the water cooler and brought out some oranges, which he started to squeeze into orange juice as he continued. "If you must know, you're doing me a service, too. I'm also stuck in a place in time and space, and owe a kind of debt myself. A lot of me is tied up with your progress. In order to teach you," he said, tossing the orange rinds back over his shoulder into the wastebasket, making a perfect shot every time, "I literally had to put a part of me in you. Quite an investment, I assure you. So it's a team effort all the way." He finished making the juice and handed me a small glassful. "A toast, then," I said, "to a successful partnership." "Done," he smiled. "Tell me more about this debt. To whom do you owe it?" "Oh, let's say it's just part of the house rules." "That's silly. That's no answer at all." "Silly it may be, but still I must abide by a particular set of rules in my business." He took out a small business card. It looked normal enough until I noticed a faint glow. In embossed letters it said, "Warrior Incorporated, Socrates, Proprietor, specializing in paradox, humor, and change." "Keep it safe," he said. "It may come in handy." "When you need me, when you really need me, just hold the card in both hands and call. I'll be there, one way or the other." I put the card carefully in my wallet. "I'll keep it safe, Socrates. You can count on it. By the way, you wouldn't have one of those cards with Joy's address on it, would you?" He ignored me. We were silent then, as Socrates began to prepare one of his crisp salads. Then I thought of another question. "Socrates, how do I do it? How do I open myself to the light of awareness?" "Well," he asked, answering a question with a question, "what do you do when you want to see?" I laughed. "I look." "Oh, you mean meditation, don't you?" "Yep," he answered. "And here's the core of it," he said, as he finished cutting the vegetables. "There are two simultaneous processes. One is insight, the willing of attention, the channeling of awareness to focus precisely on what you want to see. The other process is surrender, letting go of all arising thoughts. That is real meditation. That is how you cut free of the mind." We ate. I stabbed at my vegetables with a fork. He picked up each small bite with wooden chopsticks, breathing quietly as he chewed. He never picked up another bite until he was completely done with the first, as if each bite was a small meal in itself. I kind of admired the way he ate as I chomped merrily away. I finished first, sat back, and announced, "I guess I'm ready to have a go at real meditation." "Ah, yes," he put down his chopsticks, "conquering the mind. If only you were interested." "I am interested. I want self-awareness. That's why I'm here." "You want self-image, not self-awareness. You're here because you have no better alternatives. Because your deepest craving is survival. You want forever. You desire eternity. In your deluded belief that you are this mind or spirit or soul, you find the escape clause in your contract with mortality. Perhaps as mind you can wing free of the body when it dies, hmm?" "It's a thought," I grinned. "That's exactly what it is, Dan, a thought, no more real than the shadow of a shadow. Consciousness is not in the body. Rather, the body is in consciousness. And you are that consciousness. Not the phantom mind which troubles you so. You are the body, but you are everything else too. That is what your vision revealed to you. Only the mind is deluded, threatened by change. So if you will just relax mindlessly into the body, immortality is already yours, but not in the way you imagine or hope for. You have been immortal since before you were born and will be long after the body dissolves. The body is consciousness. It is immortal. It only changes. The mind, your own personal beliefs and history and identity, is the only mortal. So who needs it?" Socrates signed off by relaxing into his chair. "If I'm not my thoughts, what am I?" He looked at me as if he'd just finished explaining that one and one are two, and then I'd asked, "Yes, but what are one and one?" He reached over to the refrigerator, grasped an onion, and shoved it into my hand. "Peel it, layer by layer," he demanded. I started peeling. "What do you find?"
"Well, another layer."
"Continue." I peeled off a few more layers.
"Just more layers, Sock."
"Continue peeling until there are no more layers. What do you find?"
"Well, there's nothing left."
"There is something left, all right."
"What's that?"
"The universe. Consider that as you walk home." I looked out the window. It was almost dawn. I came in the next night, after a mediocre meditation session, still brimming with thoughts. There wasn't much early evening business, so we sat back sipping peppermint tea, and I told him about my lackluster meditation practice. "Yes, your attention is still diffused. Let me tell you another story." A Zen student asked his Roshi the most important element of Zen. The Roshi replied, "Attention." "Yes, thank you," the student replied, "but can you tell me the second most important element?" And the Roshi replied, "Attention." Puzzled, I looked up at Sock, waiting for more.
"That's all, folks," he said.
I stood up to get some water, and Socrates asked me, "Are you paying close attention to your standing?"
Yes, I answered, not at all sure that I was.
I walked over to the dispenser. "Are you paying close attention to your walking?" he asked.
"Yes, I am," I answered, starting to catch on to the game.
"Are you paying close attention to how you talk?"
"Well, I guess so," I said, listening to my voice. I was getting flustered.
"Are you paying attention to how you think?" he asked.
"Socrates, give me a break. I'm doing the best I can."
He leaned toward me. "Your best is not good enough. The intensity of your attention must burn. Aimlessly rolling around a gym mat doesn't develop a champion. Sitting with your eyes closed and letting your attention roam doesn't train your awareness."
"But why should a warrior sit around meditating?" I asked. "I thought this was a way of action."
"Meditation is the action of inaction. Yet you are quite correct that the warrior's way is more dynamic. Ultimately, you will learn to meditate your every action. Yet at the beginning, sitting meditation serves as a ceremony, a special time set aside to increase the intensity of practice. You must master the ritual before you can expand it properly into daily life. As a teacher, I will use every method and artifice in my command to get you interested and to help you persevere with the work ahead. If I had just walked up to you and told you the secret of happiness, you would not have heard me. You needed a guy to fascinate you, do a soft shoe, or jump up on rooftops before you could get a little interested. Well, I'm willing to play games, for a little while at least, but there comes a time when every warrior must walk the path alone. For now, I'll do what is necessary to keep you here, learning this way." I felt manipulated and angry. "So I can grow old sitting in this gas station like you, waiting to pounce on innocent students?" I regretted my remark as soon as it slipped out. Socrates, unfazed, smiled and spoke softly. "Don't mistake this place or your teacher, Dan. Things and people are not always as they seem. I am defined by the universe, not by this station. As to why you should stay, what you can gain, isn't it obvious? I am completely happy, you see. Are you?" A car pulled in just then, clouds of steam surrounding its radiator.
"Come," Sock said. "This car is suffering, and we may have to put it out of its misery."
We both went out to the stricken car, whose radiator was boiling and whose owner was in a foul mood, fuming.
"What took you so long? I can't wait around here all night, damn it!"
Socrates looked at him with nothing less than loving compassion. "Let's see if we can help you, sir, and make this only a minor inconvenience." He had the man drive into the garage, where he put a pressure cap on the radiator and found the leak. Within a few minutes, he'd welded the hole shut, but told the man that he would still need a new radiator in the near future. "Everything dies and changes, even radiators," he winked at me. As the man drove away, the truth of Sock's words sank in. He really was completely happy. Nothing seemed to affect his happy mood. In all the time I'd known him, he had acted angry, sad, gentle, tough, humorous, and even concerned. But always, happiness had twinkled in his eyes, even when tears welled up in them. I thought of Socrates as I walked home, my shadow growing and shrinking as I passed under each street light. I kicked a stone into the darkness as I neared my apartment, walking softly down the driveway to the back, where my little converted garage apartment waited under the branches of a walnut tree. It was only a few hours away from dawn. I lay in bed, but couldn't sleep. I wondered whether I could discover his secret of happiness. It seemed even more important right now than jumping up onto rooftops. Then I remembered the card he had given me. Quickly, I got out of bed and turned on the light. Reaching into my wallet, I extracted the card. My heart started to beat rapidly. Socrates had said that if I ever really needed him, to hold the card in both hands and just call. Well, I was going to test him. I stood for a moment, trembling. My knees were starting to shake. I took the softly glowing card in both hands and called, "Socrates! Come in, Socrates! Dan calling!" I felt like a complete fool standing there at 4:55 in the morning, holding a glowing card, talking to the air. Nothing happened. I tossed the card carelessly onto the dresser in disappointment. That's when the lights went out. "What?" I yelled as I spun around, trying to sense if he was there. In classic movie style, I took a step backwards, tripped over my chair, bounced off the edge of the bed, and sprawled on the floor. The lights went back on. If someone had been within earshot, that person might have assumed I was a student having trouble with ancient Greek studies. Why else would I be yelling at 5:02 in the morning, "God damn it, Socrates!" I'd never know whether the blackout had been a coincidence or not. Socrates had only said he'd come. He hadn't said how. I sheepishly picked up the card to put it back in my wallet, when I noticed it had changed. Underneath the last lines, paradox, humor, and change, appeared two words in bold print, "Emergencies only." Laughing, I fell asleep in no time at all. Summer workouts had begun. It was good to see old familiar faces. Herb was growing a beard. Rick and Sid were cultivating their dark summer tans and looked slimmer and stronger than ever. I wanted so much to share my life and the lessons I'd been learning with my teammates, but I just didn't know where to begin. Then I remembered Sock's business card. Before warm-up began, I called Rick over. "Hey, I want to show you something." Once he saw that glowing card and Sock's specialties, I knew he'd want to know more about it. Maybe they all would. After a dramatic pause, I pulled the card out and flipped it over to him. "Take a look at this. Pretty strange, huh? That guy's a teacher of mine." Rick looked down at the card, turned it over, then looked back up at me, his face blank as the card. "Is this a joke, Dan? I don't get it." I looked at the card, then turned it over. I grunted, stuffing the piece of paper back into my wallet. "Just a mistake, Rick. Let's warm up." I sighed inwardly. Socrates, I thought, what a cheap trick, disappearing ink. That night I had the card in my hand when I walked into the office. I threw it down on the desk. "I wish you'd quit playing practical jokes, Socrates. I'm tired of looking like an idiot." He looked at me sympathetically. "Oh, have you been looking like an idiot again?" "Socrates, come on. I'm asking you, will you please quit it?" "Quit what?" "The gag with the disappear..." Out of the corner of my eye, I caught a soft glow from the vicinity of the desk. The card stood face up, saying, "Warrior Incorporated, Socrates, proprietor, specializing in paradox, humor, and change. Emergencies only." "I don't get it," I murmured. "Does this card change?" "Everything changes," he replied. "Yes, I know, but does it disappear and appear again?" "Everything disappears and appears again." "Socrates, when I showed it to Rick, there was nothing there." "It's the house rules," he shrugged, smiling. "You're not being particularly helpful. I want to know how..." "Let it go," he said. "Let it go." Summer passed quickly, with intensive workouts and late nights with Socrates. We spent half the time practicing meditation and the other half working in the garage or just relaxing over tea. At times like these, I would ask about Joy. I longed to see her again. Socrates would tell me nothing. With vacation's end imminent, my mind drifted back to the coming classes. I was walking down Telegraph Avenue to do some shopping and had just come out of the pharmacy with toothpaste when a scrawny teenager came up to me, so close I could smell stale alcohol and sweat. "Spare some change, can't you?" he asked, not looking at me. "No, sorry," I said, not feeling sorry at all. As I walked away, I thought, get a job. Then vague guilt came into my mind. I'd said no to a penniless beggar. Angry thoughts arose. He shouldn't walk up to people like that. I was halfway down the block before I realized all the mental noise I had tuned into and the tension it was causing, just because some guy had asked me for money and I'd said no. In that instant, I let it go. Feeling lighter, I took a deep breath, shook off the tension, and turned my attention to the beautiful day.